hello, hello. There we are. Okay, this is the first time I've done this with this new console, so minor technical difficulties every step of the way, but I hear you and you're on the air, and let me just introduce you. I'm going to go from the page in your book that says about the author. Moon Unit Zappa is a writer, yogi, mom, artist, nature lover, podcaster, and tea baroness. I will also add rock and roll singer, actress, consultant, from what I know, daughter of America's most eclectic and prolific composer, who was also happened to be a rock and roll musician. Welcome aboard, Moon Unit Zappa. How you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for doing this. I appreciate this. We are community radio, so, you know, the madness ensues. And so the first question I wanted to just ask, what made you write the book? What made you go, I want to tell this story?
Well, originally, I've been asked about a gazillion times, what was it like growing up with Frank Zappa for a father? And originally I thought it was Gail's story to tell. Gail and Frank introduced themselves to me as Frank and Gail from out of the gate. And Gail was the adult opposite my father. Gail knew all the inside jokes and was devoted to Frank and loved the music and knew the references, et cetera. And I just felt like it wasn't my story to tell until Gail, when she died, in her will, she basically said that Dweezil and I could have nothing to do with Frank's intellectual property, and essentially saying, I wish these two of my children well, but not these other two, infinitely.
Ouch.
And this was a big, I had to rethink what everything I understood as family, trust, connection, so and on and on. So that was really, I thought, okay, I'm going to work this like a cold case and see. Was it always there, or did I miss something? Did I do something?
Now the question I have to ask, what was the best part of writing the book?
Well, part of it was just being in nature. I gave myself the gift of writing it in a beautiful place, because I knew I was going to, as I call it, I was doing some spelunking in hell, and when I pulled the rope, it was me pulling myself out of it. So it helped a lot to be able to just recuperate in nature. So that was one of the best things I did for myself.
Okay, now the next question is, what was the worst, was there a worst part of writing the book? And if there was, what was it?
Probably re-traumatizing myself. I did not anticipate how difficult some of the material would be to look at. For example, when I turned the book in, I did not even include any of the Valley Girl portions of my life, and so that was in my blind spot. So I had to go back, and that was some of the last stuff that I wrote. And if you have read the book, or if you're going to get the book, that you'll see why.
I'm up to chapter 12, so there we go. I got past the Popeye thing, which we'll talk about eventually. I saw a podcast with you and Amit a little while back, and can't mention some of the things you mentioned there because we are on, in fact, broadcast radio. How have your brothers and sister reacted to all this? Like, what's the vibe been? Where's everybody at with the thing? Or can you say?
Well, unfortunately, I don't speak to Diva and Dweezil. That's their decisions. But
okay.
Amit and I are we've done a lot of healing, and we've talked through a lot of stuff, and ultimately all of us got the same or different versions of some of the weird ingredients, and we've all kind of processed it differently. And in Amit's case, he and I just have a lot more in common. I think we're the only two that have actually had therapy in the family, and so the podcast was just a joy to do, because I was so surprised that Amit did read the book and loved it. And he's a real brother, saying, "But why did you talk about blah 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 blah?"
Why did you bring that up?
Exactly.
And it is brought up in the book so far, so I have noticed this. Here's a question. What might be the most surprising fact or story or thing in the book that people might not be expecting?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, different people have been responding to different aspects of the story. One of my favorite stories in it is an interaction I had with Katie Lang when I worked for VH1, and that's just, it's kind of a fun story. And obviously the Woody Harrelson story gets a lot of laughs. You haven't got to those.
I have not got.
Like, oh my God,
gotten.
I know.
So am I going to be like, oh my goodness, is that where we're going to go there?
Yeah, yeah, you might need a fainting couch. Anybody, yeah. A set of some sort.
Well, I am kind of a product of the permissive 70s, so I might not. You never know. Now, I have a list of questions here. So have any of the ex-mothers or any Frank's bandmates, have they ever contacted you or talked to you about any of this? Has anybody said, hey, got your book, it's pretty amazing, I'm not in there?
Scott Tunis and Ian Underwood have reached out, and that was really nice.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm guessing Ian's a real sweet guy, just from everything I know.
Yeah, he's a real sweetie.
Well, that's really great, actually, because he was so much a part of that band at that point in time. I mean, he's really Frank's right-hand man through all of that, so he has the inside thing, too.
But I mean, he's still going. He's a force, you know? He's unbelievable.
He does stuff, yeah. And now here's another question, because one of my favorite concert of all time was actually seeing Captain Beefheart in 81, I think just after Reagan got elected. Boo. And so what was it like being near Beefheart? Was he like one of the guys you were like, yeah, don't get too close? Or was he?
So Captain Beefheart, one of my most vivid memories was seeing him in our living room, and he had just drilled a hole in his nose with a sharpened pencil. And I was just fascinated by this act, and years later, I got a nose ring.
Okay,
that interaction.
He inspired you.
I didn't do it with a pencil, though. No.
And I will tell you my brief interaction with him briefly, and then we'll move on, is after the show, we were just gobsmacked, and we ran back behind the club, and we couldn't get in. There was a big fence, but he was sitting on a stack of guitar cases, and I yelled out like a dummy, you know, you want to yell something slick and clever, and of course I didn't do that. I yelled out, you're the greatest, and he pointed back at me with the marker, and he went, put that in a band. So that's my weird interaction with Don Van Vliet. So this is going to sound like the most obvious question, but what was it like growing up in Hollywood? I mean, just what was that like, you know, just going to Hollywood High and being with that stuff? Or did you go to Hollywood High?
So Hollywood is an accelerated learning environment. It's just you get to the top of the mountain faster. So, for example, when you meet all your idols so early on and they're just interested in drinking or doing drugs or having shallow conversations, you go, is that it? That's what you do at the top of the top?
Yeah, so, seems a little superficial, right?
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting in terms of that it made me pursue other things beyond, well, what's beyond the top then? What matters beyond that? So I think that's why I've just had such an interest in psychology and science and the body and what it's like to actually inhabit a body, because it's, you know, it's a weird goodie bag that we all get.
Yeah, well, the meat puppet is a weird thing.
Yeah.
There's an old quote, and I don't know if it's applicable here, and I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember the exact wording, but it says something to the effect of, all sad families are different, all happy families are the same. And so that's to predicate this question. Did you know at the time that your childhood was really kind of unique, like mom and dad are a little bit different from everybody else? Did you notice that immediately, or was it kind of like, hey, wait a minute, you know?
Well, I would say that very early on, I had feelings of obviously amazing joy and discomfort. And so then once I got into elementary school and then middle school, then you can do the comparison and be like, check, check, check. Oh, not a check. You know, and going back and forth to see, for example, other families eat dinner together. We had two meals a year, Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner, and always with an audience. There was not that kind of family intimacy, and just to name a most basic thing.
Did you miss that? Was that a thing?
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, that's it became, I mean, I feel like people that are missing whatever it is they're missing, they're experts in what's valuable. And so missing those things, then those things are extremely valuable to me. So and becoming a parent was extremely healing, and it's wonderful.
I know when I became a dad, I said to myself, I do not want my child to wind up, I had a bit of a rough upbringing, and you say to yourself, I don't want my kid to go through what I went through. Did you say that to yourself, like when your daughter came along, did you go, okay, here's how I'm going to change the game?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I find it really interesting when people don't stop the patterns that that get handed down through the DNA strand, and you know, why carry forward the terrible stuff? Just find a way to put an end to it. You be on the front lines and change it. So I'm sure I've made different mistakes, but I tried my hardest to not make the mistakes that I experienced growing up.
Now, how do you feel your past affects your present now? Like, I haven't read the whole book, so I'm sure you've explained that. But how do you feel there's trauma and joy, et cetera. How do you feel it affects you in the moment now?
Well, I'm definitely a solution person. So I really, if I feel a tug into the past, it's called glance, don't stare. And I try not to head into the future either, because they both rob you of what's right in front of you. So that's been one of the gifts of revisiting the past so thoroughly. It's almost like exposure therapy. You're like, never again. I'd rather be present.
Stay and now I'm going to ask another completely. How did you wind up doing tea, being a tea maven? How did that work out?
Well, tea was one of my biggest happy places growing up. Gail was raised in London for a time, and she carried the tea tradition on in our family. So we had tea, milky, sugary tea in our baby bottles, and
Thai food.
And that was how when there was company, that was one of the things that was offered to. It seemed like the women got tea and the men got coffee. It wasn't that simple, but so tea has always been something that has just been a fascination. And then I went to India and I saw tea plantations and on. So I'm endlessly interested in tea, in storytelling. These are the kinds of things that just light my entire circuitry up.
Okay. So,
and I have a tea company, and people can buy my tea on moonunit.com. And I made a tea for my books. You can smell a book and drink a book.
There you go. Now, how was the whole, and I can't even begin, sidebar, I have a little recording studio, failed musician. I'm now on the radio, but I still make records and stuff. And yes, your dad was kind of one of my templates for living in the basement with the recording gear. But I wonder, what was it like with the whole Valley Girl thing? Like, I haven't gotten to that chapter, obviously. How did that, suddenly you're on TV, suddenly you're on the radio, suddenly, you have this private existence, and suddenly now you have this vastly public existence. What was that like? What was the impact there? I mean,
well, in the book, I really take the reader through the quest. Is genius worth the collateral damage, and the impact on other people? So when I hear the word genius, I don't think I hear it the same way other people hear. I hear, oh, whose backs were they able to do what they did, and were they considered therefore not culpable for their behavior because they're a genius? And so these are things that are I don't know, that's just the way I approached it. I also approached it like I was a detective working a cold case. But ultimately, with the Valley Girl stuff, it was a moment of time with my father, probably about 17 minutes worth of time in his studio, when I was missing him so terribly, and I slid a note under the door and I said, hey, you love the studio, maybe we could work together. And I didn't think of anything beyond just some time with him, making him laugh and doing a funny voice that I heard in at my school. And so when he put it on the album, and then that was the breakout song after he had 20 plus years of albums and probably 34 albums or something like that at that time in his 40s and hadn't had radio, FM radio airplay. It was frustrating to him, and so there was a lot of confusing feelings around that experience.
Sure. Well, so what was your impression of the whole media onslaught that came at you at that point?
Well, I was just a kid trying to get my geometry homework. And yeah. I wasn't one of those kids that was like, I've got to be on in front of people. I'm quite shy, and so it was extremely uncomfortable for me. And I didn't pursue it. I was still trying to figure out how to cut my sweatshirt in the flash dance style of the day.
Yep. And just out of curiosity, do you ever and you talk about playing the harp? Do you ever play the harp at all, or do you ever play an instrument at all while at this point in time?
I have a tabla and I have a harmonium, and I noodle on the piano, and I have a guitar that I just I mostly stare at, but I sometimes play.
Oh, that's fantastic, though. Somebody said to me that the playing a musical instrument is the best, greatest magic trick ever. You're making an inanimate object sing. So
that's a nice description.
Yeah. I encourage people. I bump into people and I ask them, "Do you play an instrument?" And sometimes they go, "I would like to," and I go, "You can." You just can't.
Yeah.
You don't have to be great. You just have to enjoy it. That's really the key.
Right.
And
yeah.
So do you ever think of doing any kind of music at all, or is it just a personal?
I would love to do music. I think it would be a lot of fun. I don't play well enough to create in that manner. But mm-hmm. I'm messing around on GarageBand, and I'm looking for patient musicians to collaborate with.
Well, I am available. But I was also going to say, and I will give you a word of encouragement, because I say this to everybody who just says what you've just said to me. You're probably better than you think you are. I've generally found when people are very humble about their abilities, they're usually quite a bit better. It's the people who go, "Oh yeah, I'm fantastic," and
Do I hear a funny story about my music? I don't know if you have time.
Sure, go right ahead. No, we got plenty of time. Tell me the story.
In my 20s, I sent a cassette. I wrote some songs, and I sent them to three producers. One was Brian Eno, one was John Bryan, and one was, I can't think of his name, he did the Bleach album, the Nirvana album.
Oh, not Butch Vig, the other guy there.
No, yeah, the other guy. And I can't think of his name, but only he replied. And he sent back an 8-page fax. Maybe it was an email that I printed out on fax.
Right.
But it was a thorough and scathing account of what he had endured. But in my head, I was thinking, okay, he could make my corny stuff edgy. Brian Eno can make it bring something out, and John Bryan, I just loved him so much. So when I got that letter, and he was like, "You're not Aretha Franklin, you're not," like, it went on and on.
Ouch.
And I called him and I said, "You seem to have a grasp on what's not working. When can you start?"
Well, that's okay. I got rejected by Interscope, so there you go.
Well, no, but we did work together, Jack and Dino. Yeah.
Oh, that's why.
We ended up working together, yeah, because I said, "You really seem to know what's not working." So we did give it a little shot.
Well, that's what a good producer actually does, is they go, "Yep, this part's working, this part doesn't work."
So, it's pretty funny.
We have a couple more minutes. What would you like to tell the audience about your book? Like, okay, so let's just imagine, so the average listener now knows a little bit about you, but is not fully familiar with the story. Give them the blurb. What about your book would affect them, or what kind of window does it give to them? What would you think?
Well, I think if you feel like a fish out of water in your own home, if you feel like a fish out of water in your external world, if you feel marginalized, if you feel that you are struggling with being not seen or heard, I think these are kind of universal things that are relatable. And if you're going to write up a will, another takeaway is make it even, Stevens, because the best fans stay together because they have shared publishing.
Yep. Well, this is actually, you made a valid point. an extremely valid point. Mm-hmm. And so many of us do feel kind of like, you know, as a child, I identified with Billy Mumy from Lost in Space, like a lot of people, like, why am I even on this planet, you know? And one of the things that I loved about your book is you share so much of your internal dialogue that you were having in real time there and then in retrospect now. How was that for you, like going through those journals and drawing the things from it? How did you feel? I mean, did you feel like, did I really say that? Did I really write that? Or did you go, yep, that's me?
Probably a combination, but ultimately I was, what I did to map it was if you come from trauma, then, and this is the kind of trauma that's psychological and emotional. There's no visible bruises. I say it left a trademark instead of a mark, but,
Emotional ones leave bigger scars, I think.
And it's harder to heal from this kind of stuff. And so I just felt like if I'm struggling and I have resources, then somebody else that maybe doesn't, maybe this would help them, especially because I know that naming things as well as you can gives some pressure relief so art, music, dance, these things have saved my life, so I felt it was my obligation to offer some stuff, and also humor. That's one of my other big nature, humor, moving my body. That kind of stuff. These are some of the ways. And then there's a big fun reveal at the end that's one of the weirdest things I think a person could do to heal, physician heal thyself.
Well, I think it's pretty courageous to do that, to place that out and go, here's my story. And I truly admire what I've read so far and your position there, or your stance. And just astounded by your candor. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And I think it takes a lot of courage to be that honest, straight out. This is what my life really was. Because you do sort of almost paint a target on yourself, and then you hope, well, geez, I hope their aim is really bad. And generally is for the people that try to shoot at you, you know.
But the process of healing requires true honesty with yourself. It really does. And so I felt like some of the stuff I needed to bring into daylight was there was no other way to do it except to say this is the stuff that I'm working with. And again, I hope that it people get there faster than I did. And I mean the self-love world and getting rid of the negative voice in your head. That lives beyond death, and so that's the thing that I'm helping myself mend.
Well, I think that's the most beautiful message in your book is about that love yourself, love yourself, love yourself, the statement that I read there. And I want to thank you for doing this interview. I really appreciate it. I am going to tell everybody who's listening, you really should read this book. It's fantastic. And I've read Pauline's book, and I've read all the other books. This one is much more human and clear and creates a very, very almost delicate picture of the whole thing, like a painting almost, where everything is moving but very, very smoothly, if you will. And I enjoyed the book, and I really enjoyed talking with you. And I want to thank you for doing this interview. I appreciate it. Hopefully, you know, your dad once said that interviews were one step away from the Inquisition. I hope I hope I made this comfortable and easy for you. And I would like to ask you one more favor, if you could. You make us legal? Okay, so on the radio, you have to do out your call numbers. Could you say, this is Moon Zappa, and you're listening to WCUW 91.3 FM?
Wait, W what?
WCUW 91.3
FM. WCUW 91.3
FM?
Yeah. WCUW 91.3 FM. So, hi, this is Moon Unit Zappa, and you're listening to WCUW 91.3 FM.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, we're going. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for that. That was wonderful. You know, Jack Mercer is up in the ether, smiling at both of us right now. And I appreciate that so much. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes,
and
nothing makes my siblings cringe more than me doing pop.
That makes it even better. I thank you very much. I appreciate this so much. And you know, if you want to do any musical collaboration, let me know. I'm hanging around, and I got to record. recording studio.
Okay.
And it keeps me out of the schoolyard. So there you go. Thank you. And I'll share with the radio audience. I told you before we went on the air, I'm inheriting a new kitten. My cat passed away 4 weeks ago. She was my guardian and protector. She really was. She was my 18 years of just pure love. And as I said before, the Universal Cat Distribution System has bestowed upon me a kitten that I'm picking up on Wednesday. And of course, that kitten is going to be named Mooney after you, because the universe decides to make everything connect at once. Thank you very
much. Am I a calico? What am I?
It's a little gray kitten with blue eyes. And she's a floof, so I'll be sweeping again, because my other cat was a Maine Coon, and she was a floof, too. So,
great.
So thank you very much, and have a beautiful evening and a beautiful day.
Okay, you too. Thanks so much. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.